is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. You are about to hear from Pat Brooks, telling about the great rally race he and his wife Mary made across China in 1997.
I'm your host today, Paul Wearson, and I'm a proud driver of a 1996 Buick. So it gives me special pleasure to bring you Pat Brooks today as our guest, who's been driving and restoring vintage Buicks since 1974. And we're inspired by a recent program we had about the trip Brian McNamara and Lee Kilmer took from Story City to Fairbanks, Alaska, in their Model T Ford pickups. Well, we asked Pat to tell us about his two rallies in his 1949 Buick Woody. One across China in 1997, and one around the world in 2000. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's going to be fun to talk about all this. I understand you were in Marshalltown originally. Is that right?
Right. I lived in Marshalltown for 35, 36 years, and then we moved here to Ames because we have a daughter and three grandchildren and son-in-law here. So I'm now retired, and it's been a great life.
Well, now, you were a lawyer, is that correct?
I was, right.
And you also have great mechanical skills. You restore vintage cars, is that right?
Well, I did. For many years, I would buy cars that were oftentimes in poor repair and needed to be worked on, and I'd restore them. I had a lot of parts. For years, I would buy brand new parts at Buick dealers. I'd clean out their parts bins, the old parts that they were going to take to the dump. We were literally, and I would buy them for $100 and load up everything I could get in my trailer and my car and take them back. So I had a lot of parts.
Now, why were you partial to Buicks? Now, I'm kind of partial to Buicks, too. What is it about Buicks?
Well, Buick has a tremendously fine reputation for mechanical performance and ruggedness, and they kept the straight 8 engine until the last series it had was 1953, and they had that engine perfected, and it was a wonderful engine, and the mechanics were great, and they stayed on the road for years, and many of the manufacturers were constantly making changes in an effort to save money, and Buick just built it right to begin with and held it that way.
Well, yes, my 1996 Buick has never stranded me on the road. And, you know, my neighbor boy is at Iowa State. He's a sophomore. And it occurs to me that my car is the same age he is. And so it's still on the road. So I've got to say that my Buick engine has really lasted, too. Now, this Woody, explain what a Woody is for those of us who are younger.
Well, a Woody is a cargo vehicle. And so it's built on the convertible frame, which is traditionally a heavier frame, and has heavier suspension and was made for rugged work. And it's a vehicle that you can fold the seats down in and have a lot of cargo space, and yet it has an attractive appearance because of the wood that's hung on the outside. Now, early Woodies, the body was basically all wood. Now, in 1949, they changed that, and the wood was actually screwed to the sheet metal, and the body became a unified body and was much sturdier and more stable.
So you rebuilt the Woody. Now, how did you hear about this China thing?
Well, I was reading a car magazine that I subscribed to, actually a newspaper, and there was about a two tiny little paragraph article about this fellow in London who was going to organize this Peking to Paris rally. And so I wanted to do that, and I called him and talked to him and got signed up, and Buick came on board to sponsor me, and Popular Mechanics and Steel Rubber Products and a number of other sponsors. And so I decided to do it, and it worked out quite well. Now, we actually just drove from Beijing, which is known as Peking before the revolution, and
where is Beijing in terms of the continent or the country?
Beijing is in Lower Mongolia. This is actually northern China, and it's about 120 miles from the coast. And so we started at the Great Wall of China. The Great Wall of China is the tourist area, what people call the Great Wall, is actually just outside of Beijing. And so we started there, and we headed west, and we drove in a bit of a southwesterly direction, and we drove to the border of Tibet for Buick. Now, Buick wanted us to do this and hired us under contract to do this, and my job was to prepare the car and get it shipped to China and take care of all the details and show up there with the car to meet the president of the Buick Corporation at the Great Wall of China with a lot of executives and start this rally. It was quite an undertaking.
Well, how many cars were involved in the rally?
Well, I believe it was something like 70 or 80 on this particular rally. And as I say, we drove to the border of Tibet. Now, the reason Buick wanted us to do this was in 1997, which is when this occurred, Buick opened its factory in China. And it's making Buicks even today in China. And indeed, they sell more Buicks in China and Asia than they do the entire United States.
Is that right?
That's right. It's a huge operation. And Buick is a status car in China because many of the communist rulers and even the pre-communist rulers had Buicks. And they're in museums over there, Chinese museums. You will find a 1940 Buick.
Is that right?
It was driven by the people who were in charge of China's government before the revolution, actually.
Well, now, when you got out there on the road in China, out in the more hinterland area when you were driving, what did you encounter? There were a lot of villages and long stretches that just open road, I suppose.
Well, you have to realize that China was a country which lived in isolationism for many, many, many years. And so we drove through these tiny villages, and people there might have seen a picture of a European, but they'd never seen a European. Wow. And they wanted to reach through the window of your car and touch your hair and touch your skin. And they wanted to touch your car, and they wanted to talk to you. And they wanted to actually, frankly, to make friends with you so that they could come to the United States. And they openly talked about that.
Is that right?
And you'd pull into a tiny village, and the people you could speak to almost always were children who were taking English in school, and they were the translators. And many of these were very small children, but they would translate for the adults and for us. And it was a very interesting experience. Now, the towns there, which we would call big towns, were just oftentimes small by their standards. There'd be 100,000 people. And we would come into town, and we were on kind of the main thoroughfare. And we could look ahead and see the downtown, and people were standing literally elbow to elbow, crammed in there to see us. And the organizers of the rally cautioned us and said, when you get in there, don't stop. Because if you stop, the people will pack around your car so tightly that you won't be able to move forward without running over them. So you have to keep moving, because if you keep moving, they won't get packed in around you, and they are more apt to move out of your way. And that's what we had to do. And so it was the people were tremendously interested in Europeans and in our cars and us and coming to the United States.
So when you drove down those streets in those towns, you were like Dwight Eisenhower in the victory parade in New York City after World War II.
Exactly.
Just a big motorcade. Now, when you got out into the countryside, the condition of the roads, were they paved or were they mostly gravel?
Well, on the roads were all these homemade little carts people had made out of little engines, like what we would see at a farm auction or a farm show, a little engine from the 1900s, 19-teens, maybe these little farm engines. And they'd make these little homemade vehicles, and they were going down the road, and there were donkeys and horses and people on bikes and all kinds of things. So you had to be very careful. And the roads were in very poor condition. They were not made for modern vehicles or anything that would be high speed. And so there was tremendous construction. There was construction going on everywhere. And just to kind of transition from this to the Around the World trip, when we went back 3 years later for the Around the World, they had built new roads almost everywhere, and they built brand new gas stations the entire length of China. And I'm talking again about gas stations that are as big as any truck stop here in town.
Talking about what time period? How many years?
Only 3 years.
3 years, all this construction happened, so it presented an entirely different environment when right. he came through the second time.
That's right.
That's a marvelous transition yeah. in a short time.
We would stop to get gasoline the second trip in the around the world, which was 2000. The Peking to Paris was 1997. We would stop at these huge gas stations, and attractive young Chinese girls in short skirts would come out with hot tea for you, wash your windshield, check your oil, and put the gasoline in the gas tank for you. It was like going back to the 1940s.
Full-service gas station in every sense of the word.
Absolutely.
On your first trip, was there enough gas at critical points to keep you going without, you know, before all that construction happened?
Well, gas was a real problem in 1987 because we had to find it along the way. And many times we actually found it in mud huts and very primitive circumstances, and the locals would see us coming through, and they would want to sell us the gas, and so they put water in it. They stretched it.
They diluted the gasoline.
Well, they were making money, and so that was a problem. You had to be very careful, and so we had trouble getting gas. Now, in some places, there was simply not enough gas for all of the cars we had, and so the organizers in several times brought in these great big gasoline tankers, and we gassed straight from the tankers. And that was good gas.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're talking, what, 70 cars in this caravan?
Yeah, approximately.
Now, were they all vintage Buicks or were various years or models?
They were older cars, and I think the newest one I think you could have, and again, this has been 20 years ago that I did this, was like 1960-something. But the oldest car around the world, for example, was a 1914 Rolls-Royce, and it didn't even make it out of England. We started in London and headed west towards Istanbul, and it didn't even make it. But there were all lots of cars, and they were in different classes, and all the years were represented, so there was a mix of cars.
So during the China trip in 97, now, was there a moment? What's the worst thing that happened? I always ask people, what was the worst thing that happened?
Well, the worst thing that happened was we got a load of bad gas and near the border of Tibet, actually right on the border of Tibet. We slept that night in a sheep and goat pasture among a herd of sheep and goats, and we couldn't get the car started the next morning because the gasoline had been so badly watered. Mm. Now, it was one of those deals where if your engine was hot, as we would say, the head was hot, where the explosion really starts, you could tolerate. The engine would tolerate it. But when the engine was cold, it just had enough water in it that you couldn't get the engine to run. And we weren't the only ones who had problems with that. But we were hired by Buick to go across China so they would have a presence in this rally and be visible to the people and generate all this publicity in the Chinese press. And we were able to get that done because we did make it to the border of Tibet.
And so I'm sure there were maintenance people along with parts and all this sort of thing.
Okay, now that's a really interesting issue because many of these people were not, they were wealthy foreigners, basically, and they took a mechanic with them.
Oh, they did.
They took the mechanic that had worked on the car, and the mechanic's way was paid and his fees were paid and everything, so he had a free trip, and he may not have gotten a salary. I never met one that did have a salary, but they were riding with the owners. Now, you have to realize that these mechanics had varying degrees of skills out in the wilderness.
Okay.
If they were in their garage, they were fine. But problem solving out in the middle of nowhere without all of the resources that we would have at home was another matter. And some of them were very ingenious. And they were able to enlist the help of local Chinese people in little tiny workshops and mud huts that were welding. And I helped on some occasions with various projects and this kind of thing. But the rally people had two trouble trucks, what we called trouble trucks, and they would help you. And the rules said they could help you for up to 10 minutes. Now, they'd help you longer than that if somebody else didn't need help. Yeah. But if there were other people who needed help, they were going to go help them. And so very interestingly, by the end of the rally, it was obvious which mechanics were ingenious and resourceful and could keep the cars running. And so there was a competition between the owners of these cars to hire other people's mechanics away from them for the next rally.
Right.
Because their mechanic wasn't very good, but this guy's was.
So it really was a merit-based system certain mechanics had status based on actual skills.
That's right.
Now, what was your destination on this trip?
Well, the destination on this trip was really for us ended up being the border of Tibet, but the rally went on to Paris, and we didn't take that leg. We were having car problems as well, so that's where that ended. But on the around the world, we started in London, and we then ended in London, and we crossed all of Europe and Asia and Alaska and North America and Northern Africa. And
well, I want to hear a lot more about that. Right now, this is local KHOI radio, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area. We've been talking with Pat Brooks, telling us about the experiences in the auto rally from Beijing and the Great Wall in China to Tibet. But that was just the beginning for them. Now, the second rally was the Around the World in 80 Days for the Bicentennial in 2000. Is that what they called it, Around the World?
Around the World in 80 Days Motor
Marathon. I'm so glad we played that theme now.
Well, I was very impressed with that.
And you have pretty good work.
Huh? That's right. Put in for a race.
Good choices. Well, tell us about that Around the World trip. That's much more of a challenge, I suppose.
Yeah, that was the premier automobile event of the Millennium Celebration. And it started in London on May 1st, 2000, and 102 cars left the starting line. And there were really three rallies within a single rally. The first leg ended in Istanbul. People had actually paid to go that far, and then they went home. And so we lost about 20 or 25 cars in Istanbul. And then the next leg ended in Beijing, and Peking, as it is sometimes called. And that is a place where we again lost 20 or 25 cars. People had paid to go that far. Now, that was important because the remaining 42 cars that remained were going to board an Antonov, which is the largest military transport plane in the world. And when the Soviet Union broke down, they sold a lot of military hardware to raise money. And they sold some of these Antonovs, and a group of investors in London bought an Antonov and were doing all these special projects, including transporting 42 of our cars around the world over the oceans. And so there were a group of us who had paid to go on the plane. And if we made it to Beijing, and some people didn't make it, then we could get on the plane. Now, the people who didn't make it, their slots were filled by people who hadn't gotten signed up soon enough, but had indicated they would pay, and then they would take the place of those people who fell out. And so we packed 42 cars of the.
And you were in that group.
Oh, yes.
We made it.
We were determined to get to Beijing and get on the Antonov, and we did. In fact, so I don't forget it, this is very important. We did make it all the way under our own power, and we won a gold medal.
You did.
In the rally, yes. So in any event, they packed you on to the Antonov, and they put four of the organizers' vehicles on the Antonov as well, and these included the two trouble trucks.
So this is just a vast capacity, large deck in this plane, and you could put 40 cars in there?
You could actually put 46, I think it was 46 cars with the organizers' vehicles. Now, when you drove the cars in through the tail, and the tail hydraulically came up. Mm-hmm. So it was at a 90-degree angle, and you drove the cars on, and they were parked in several levels. I mean, this plane is huge. And then to dislodge these cars, get rid of them, the front end came up where the pilot sat, and it came at a 90-degree angle, and we drove then down through the front end.
So you drove in the back end, drove out the front end. I would really like to see a picture. Too bad we're on radio here, but I'd like to see that massive plane. And that when you flew out of there, where did you fly to then?
Well, we flew to Anchorage. Mm-hmm. The cars were transported to Anchorage, and from Anchorage then we rallied Alaska, northern Canada, northern United States, and we drove to New York, New Jersey. And from there, we then flew to northern Africa and did the Sahara and Morocco. And not to get ahead of the story here, but then we drove the Straits of Gibraltar, and when we got into Spain. Now, we hadn't driven Spain on the first part of the trip, so that was new territory. And then we went back through France and went back to London.
Well, here's a question, Pat. Who had the best roads?
Well, there, if there's any question, the best roads were in North America. When you get, this is a very interesting observation that I made, and I think it's right. It seemed right to me at the time. When you in Asia, when you got within 100 miles of the border of the country, okay, the roads just went to nothing.
Is that correct? Wow.
Well, I'm sure there are modern roads there now that that's not true of. But we didn't stay on interstates, and we didn't stay on, you know, we were on the older roads, but they just went terrible. And the reason what I finally figured out was that these countries had spent so much time over the years invading each other that they didn't want to provide a safe and fast entry route into the country with these roads. So the first 100 miles or so, you were driving under terrible conditions, and that gave the country time to react if somebody invaded them. Now, that's just the only thing I can tell you, but that's the way it was.
Wow. You know, that's very interesting observation. In fact, so much of what you've discussed today is a revelation to me in terms of not only what happened in China and what situation. That was such a chore. I can't believe all that construction went on in 3 years. Must have been a crash program. Look at the vast change in on-the-road convenience and gas stations and the road surface. Amazing.
China has had then and still has today the largest cash reserves of any country in the world. They are rich. There is tremendous wealth being generated in Asia. And we as Americans are often hear our politicians say we're the wealthiest country in the world. Well, we're the biggest debtor country in the world. Mm-hmm. And the money and the resources and the assets and the construction and in those other parts of the world is just beyond our comprehension almost, really. And so when I came home from Peking to Paris, I was reading a business magazine, and it said that something like 89% or almost 90% of all the high-rise cranes in the world were in China. And see, when they build these big buildings and have all these big projects, they rent these huge cranes from international companies, and they provide operators and maintenance and whatnot so that they can lift all these big loads and all of that. And almost all of them in the world were located in China doing this construction we're talking about. Now, I'd seen this construction, and I'd seen these high-rise cranes, but I didn't realize that until I got home and read about it.
Well, you know, that's the amazing thing about your whole story, the contrast you saw in just 3 years in China. And what an experience you had. Now, who sponsored that Around the World rally?
Well, there was an organizer in London, and he himself had been a rally driver. He organized a company to do these rallies for those of us who were not professionals and who didn't have professional rally cars and wanted to drive our antique cars and go on a great adventure. And so he organizes these. In fact, they're still being you can still go on them. But 9/11 changed a lot. You know, we felt perfectly safe driving through all of these countries where today we would not even venture. At one point, we were told by the organizers, we were 20 miles from the border of Afghanistan. And that puts it in perspective.
Oh, yes, of course. So at no time did you feel unsafe due to the political situation? Or
no, we didn't. People were so friendly and so welcoming and wanted to see the cars and have their pictures taken with the cars and talk to us. And as I said earlier, they wanted to talk about coming to the United States. And so... people were very, very good to us, and the governments were good to us. They provided security and at night and for the parking lots. In China particularly, there are so many eyes. I came to say in China there are so many eyes that if you do something wrong, the government's going to find out about it. And people were very well behaved. Now, if a police officer was around and gave them a direction, they followed it. But if they were in a hotel parking lot or in a city and a security officer gave them direction, they might not follow it.
Is that right?
And there was a fight a few times between these people. But if a police officer told you something, you did it.
And so really, you were exposed to a variety of cultures. Now, your wife, Mary, went along too. How did she enjoy that?
Well, she was my navigator. I drove the entire way from London to Beijing. And then in North America, she took over the wheel from time to time. But she was a wonderful, wonderful navigator, and she really enjoys maps. And so she spent hours and hours and hours reviewing maps and plotting out the route. And then as we as we drove, she was telling me, you know, how to drive, which she always does anyway. And
that was a friendly backseat driver.
Oh, yeah. Well, now, let's talk about that for a second. That's very interesting. You have to realize this was a rally, and so we had to get to checkpoints and meet various timetables. And it was very stressful. And this was before electronic navigation like you have in your car today. And so you had to follow a map. Oh. And you had to figure out the way. And you go to a intersection, and there might be no sign at all. And you'd have to figure out which way to turn on the Y. And if it went two ways, which way do you go? And my wife was very good about that, and we resolved those. But there were actually fist fights in the cars between these people.
Is that right?
That's right. Because they couldn't figure out which way to go, and the stress was tremendous, and they decided after the trip started they didn't like each other. They should have decided that before the trip started.
Nothing is more stressful than being in an automobile with somebody when there's an argument about where to go.
That's right. As Yogi Berra said, when you get to the Y in the road, take it. the question was, which way do you go?
That sounds like Yogi Berra. Well, you know, Pat, it's been delightful. We could talk all morning. That's been fascinating. I am just really highly respectful of what you've accomplished. You did a lot of things that really were, well, you were facing the unknown, and it was a challenge. And thanks to you and your wonderful Buick and your wonderful wife, Mary, for getting you through all this stuff.
Thank you for supporting KHOIFM.org. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Find archives of all past shows at archive.khoifm.org. See you again on the radio.